Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money that'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler,
how much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary.
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, "Show me, in a courtroom, how we were at war."
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing on the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, "If I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized."
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.
MSW Media.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Beans for Thursday, April 25th, 2024. Today, at least 18 people have been indicted by the Arizona Attorney General in the 2020 fraudulent elector scheme. The Supreme Court will hear oral arguments today on immunity in the Trump election subversion case. Trump is back on trial after the Wednesday respite in the Manhattan 2016 election interference case. A company is making payments to mystery people and being reimbursed by 5 Trump super PACs. Biden has signed the nearly $100 billion foreign aid package for Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, and Gaza. Bad news for Trump in Pennsylvania with the primary results. The Department of Justice agrees to a $138 million settlement in the Larry Nassar case. Jim Comer admits there's nothing to the Joe Biden impeachment. The Supreme Court heard oral arguments on emergency reproductive health care. The Arizona House has voted to repeal the 1864 abortion ban. The U.S. Senate has passed the TikTok divestment bill. Giuliani, Meadows, and Jenna Ellis are unindicted co-conspirators in the Michigan fraudulent electors case. The Gateway Pundit is filing for bankruptcy, and Bannon is named an unindicted co-conspirator in the Guo Wengwei indictment. I'm Allison Gill.
Who? And I'm Dana Goldberg.
Yeah, I think it, even without the Trump trial today, I think
unreal.
We have a record for the amount of news. And today was bananas. I was running late. You were running late. Then I was running late again. And I'm glad we were running late because as I'm sitting there finishing up the final touches on the script today,
bringing Arizona.
Chris, I'm like all eyes on Arizona a couple months back. Chris Mays did not disappoint. 7 redacted people have been indicted. We know who they are from the Washington Post. I'll get to that. Plus the 11 fraudulent electors, including Kelly Ward. 2 current Arizona lawmakers are in that group of fraudulent electors. And apparently there's a couple more. Trump is an unindicted co-conspirator. Chesbro. We're going to get to all of that. Of course, we'll break it down in even more detail on Cleanup on L45 next week.
I know I'm just dreaming on this, AG, but you know what? Ted Cruz was the one that stood up first in the House and said, I challenge the, you know, the electoral votes for the state of Arizona, when he doesn't even fucking live there. He's not a senator. It would be amazing if one of the redacted names was Ted fucking Cruz.
I'm not so sure about that.
It would be amazing, though.
It would be great, though. Yeah, if we're going to do a little justice fantasy.
fantasy.
That would be fantastic.
Just let me have my moment.
Yeah, and I don't know how we're going to cover this all on cleanup with the Manhattan Trump trial going on. Maybe there'll be a bonus. There's not enough podcasts to cover the year of accountability. Also, I want to say, everybody, I am a post where I have been posting a lot of my long form editorial stuff is closing down. So starting today, I have decided to start a new Substack newsletter.
Nice.
It's called The Breakdown with Allison Gill. I'm going to test it out with my summary of the Supreme Court immunity oral arguments, which are happening probably right now as you're listening to this. I'll also be live tweeting those arguments over on Twitter. But please, everybody, pause the show, take a moment, and subscribe for free to my Substack newsletter at substack.com/MuellerSheWrote. I would really appreciate you signing up to subscribe to that for free. And then later in the show today, I'm going to talk to a debate expert. She's an author and a professor of communications at Texas A&M. Her name is Jennifer Murchia, and we're going to talk about why Biden should not debate Trump this year. Also, tickets to the live shows are going fast. Seattle's almost sold out. So is Portland. But all of the tickets are available at AllisonGill.com. And then on May 7th, Brian Greer, who's, you know, as Secrets and Laws on Twitter, and Andy McCabe and myself are going to appear on a panel.
Nice.
Yeah, at the Schar School at George Mason University in Arlington, Virginia. Again, that's May 7th. It's a free event. And I have an RSVP for seats to that. I have a link in my Twitter feed from yesterday. I'll try to get it out to you another way. But right now, we're just so buried in news. We have so much. We have a lot of quick hits to get to.
To make a long story short, too late.
All right, first up, former Ambassador Nikki Haley got nearly 150,000 votes, about 17% of the vote, in the Pennsylvania closed primary on Tuesday, despite having dropped out of the race over a month ago. Biden won Pennsylvania in 2020 by 80,000 votes. Nikki Haley got 150,000 votes. That's really, really bad for Donald Trump.
It sure is. And next quick hit, we have an update on the Larry Nassar settlement. The U.S. Justice Department announced a $138.7 million settlement Tuesday with more than 100 people who accused the FBI of grossly mishandling allegations of sexual assault against Larry Nassar in 2015 and 2016. It was a critical time gap that allowed the sports doctor to continue to prey on victims before his arrest. When combined with other settlements, $1 billion now, and I still don't think that's enough, has been set aside by various organizations to compensate hundreds of women who said Nassar assaulted them under the guise of a treatment for sports injuries. So I am glad that SOB is rotting in jail, and I know it's not equal compensation, but I'm glad there is something going to these victims.
Yes, about $1 billion when you include this new DOJ settlement. Next up, the Senate passed legislation Tuesday that would force TikTok's China-based parent company to sell the social media platform under the threat of a ban within 9 months. A contentious move by U.S. lawmakers that's expected to face legal challenges and disrupt the lives of content creators who rely on the short-form video app for income. The TikTok legislation was included as part of a larger $95 billion package that provides foreign aid to Ukraine and Israel, Gaza, and Taiwan, which was passed in the Senate 79-18. It now goes to President Joe Biden, who said in a statement immediately after passage, he will sign it Wednesday.
Thank you, AG. And the founder of the Gateway Pundit, that's the infamous conspiracy theory site, they announced Wednesday that the company had declared bankruptcy.
Oh,
I know. Womp womp.
That's too bad.
I know.
What's for dinner?
Jim Hoff published a message on the website that read, and I quote, TGP Communications, the parent company of the Gateway Pundit, recently made the decision to seek protection under Chapter 11 of the United States Bankruptcy Code in the Southern District of Florida as a result of the progressive liberal warfare attacks against our media outlet. Georgia election workers Ruby Freeman and daughter Shay Moss, they sued the Gateway Pundit in December of 2021 for all their lies.
And if that wasn't enough good news for you, Jim Comer recently approached one of his Republican colleagues and made a blunt confession. He was ready to be done with the impeachment inquiry into Biden. according to the lawmaker who relayed the conversation to CNN. Comer has grown increasingly frustrated at his own investigation because it appears to be at a dead end, with Republicans resigned to the reality that they don't have the votes to impeach the president. That's according to multiple sources with direct knowledge. Bum-bum-ba-dum, womp.
Thank you so much. And they're on their third attempt in 3 weeks. The Arizona State House lawmakers, they voted Wednesday to pass a bill that would repeal the near total ban on abortion from 1864 that was upheld by the battleground state Supreme Court earlier this month. The state Senate will now be required to read their bill on the floor on three occasions in three separate sessions, meaning it will not be on track for full passage until next month. The repeal is expected to pass. Only three House Republicans, three, joined all the Democrats, every single one of them, in voting for the repeal. So I hope all those other Republicans lose their fucking seats.
Yes, and all of their seats are up for re-election this year.
Yes, they are.
And in a little noticed court filing earlier this month, federal prosecutors described Steve Bannon as a co-conspirator in a massive criminal fraud and racketeering case against a flamboyant far-right Chinese fugitive, compounding the legal headaches of the former Donald Trump advisor. Oh, so sad. FBI agents in March 2023 arrested Guo Wengwei, a self-styled anti-Chinese government activist that Bannon once advised, charging him and two associates with using a series of fraudulent investment opportunities to defraud thousands of Guo supporters in the Chinese diaspora of more than $1 billion. You'll remember Bannon was arrested for his We Build the Wall scheme, you know, by post office cops on Guo Wengwei's yacht. Those charges obviously were pardoned, but he does face them in New York and a trial scheduled for May. We'll see what happens.
All right. And last in this segment, former President Donald Trump is an unindicted co-conspirator in the Michigan Attorney General's probe into the attempts to overturn the 2020 election in that state. This is an investigator that's who testified Wednesday. The investigator also said the list of unindicted co-conspirators includes ex-Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani, former Trump White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, and former Trump campaign lawyer Jenna Ellis. We're going to cover that in the next cleanup. And why do those names sound familiar? Oh, they're the same fucking names that we just got from Arizona.
Yes, and that we had in Fulton County. And a few of them are unindicted co-conspirators in the federal case in which oral arguments on immunity are taking place right now.
Love to see it.
Yeah, it's quite a day for justice today, and we have more. So let's hit the hot notes. Hot notes. All right, first up, from Yvonne Wingett Sanchez at the Washington Post, an Arizona grand jury on Wednesday indicted seven attorneys and aides affiliated with Trump's 2020 presidential campaign, plus 11 Arizona Republicans on felony charges related to their alleged efforts to subvert Biden's 2020 victory in the state. Those indicted include former Trump White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, attorneys Rudy Giuliani, Jenna Ellis, John Eastman, and Christina Bob, first time we've seen her indicted, top campaign advisor Boris Epstein, first time we've seen that asshole indicted, and former campaign aide Mike Roman. They're accused of allegedly aiding an unsuccessful strategy to award the state's electoral votes to Trump instead of Biden. Also charged are the Republicans who signed the paperwork on December 14, 2020, that falsely purported Trump was the rightful winner, including former state party chair Kelly Ward, state senators Jake Huffman and Anthony Kern, and Tyler Bowyer, a GOP national committeeman and chief operating officer of Turning Point Action.
Oh, boy.
That's the little the Trump campaign conservative arm of Turning Point USA. Charlie Kirk is having a nice day. These indictments cap a year-long investigation, 1 year, by Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays into how the electoral strategy played out in Arizona, which Biden won by 10,457 votes. Arizona is the fourth state after Michigan, Georgia, and Nevada to seek charges against those who formed an alternate slate of electors. As those cases slowly make their way through the legal system, Trump is again running for president, and officials in Arizona and other battleground states are preparing for another likely contentious election. In releasing the indictment, Mays' office redacted the names of all of the individuals outside of Arizona who were charged until they've been served their indictments. But the Washington Post was able to identify all of them through the accounts of their alleged actions as described in the indictment.
Oh, okay.
Many of those involved in their 2020 elector strategy, which played out in Arizona and six other states, have long insisted the tactic was legal because Trump electors were only placeholders to be activated if legal challenges to Biden's win were successful in court. But Mays charges that Trump allies inside and outside of Arizona intended all along to use the electors to falsely claim that the outcome of the election was in doubt, facilitating an effort to obstruct the certification of Biden's victory. Unlike probes by state prosecutors in Michigan and Nevada, Mays took a top-to-bottom approach with her investigation. Similar to prosecutors in the Atlanta area, Mays targeted not just local conservatives who carried out the plan, but also the out-of-state middlemen in Trump's orbit, who allegedly helped put it together. But unlike in Georgia, Mays did not try to indict the former president. This is a second round of charges for Meadows, Giuliani, Ellis, Eastman, and Roman, who were all indicted alongside Trump in Georgia last year. Ellis pled guilty in October. Remember when she was crying?
Mm-hmm.
She's the lady who's told me to cry more on Twitter. Hi, Jenna. She, you know, pled guilty to illegally conspiring to overturn Trump's loss in Georgia and has been cooperating with prosecutors. I guess not hard enough. This is the first time Boris Epstein, now a top 2024 campaign aide who frequently talks with the former guy, this is the first time he's been charged for his actions in the election. Mays' case has been squarely focused on local conservatives up until late last year. Then Arizona prosecutors and investigators met in December with the Cheese, Kenneth Cheesebro, an attorney and an architect of the elector strategy, who pled guilty in Georgia in October to a single felony count of participating in a conspiracy to file false documents. Chesbro provided Mays' team with records, some that had been previously unseen, that revealed more information about those involved in the Arizona effort. That's according to two people familiar. After that, they said the Arizona investigation widened. After the election, Giuliani and Ellis frequently traveled together, and he farted on her probably the whole time, as they worked to overturn Trump's loss state by state. Both attended a November 30th, 2020 event in downtown Phoenix, attended by state GOP state and federal lawmakers, where they falsely claimed the widespread fraud had marred the election. Then Giuliani, Ellis, and other Trump allies tried to convince then Arizona House Speaker Russell Rusty Bowers to help overturn the results. Now, Christina Bobb, who has ties to Arizona, communicated with Trump allies about the strategy. After the House Speaker met with Rudy and other Trump allies, Christina Bobb emailed the then state Senate president with information that Rudy believed could be used to sow doubt on the 2020 outcome. In early December 2020, Boris Epstein emailed a Wisconsin-based attorney who was aiding the campaign and asked him to draft a sample language thing for alternate electors in seven states, including Arizona. Epstein wrote that the request came from Rudy and added, "If that's difficult, we can have councils in those states do it." Oops. In the weeks following the January 6th attack, prosecutors across the country weighed whether to investigate the pro-Trump electors. At the time, the Arizona then-Attorney General Mark Brnovich chose not to do so. But after Mays won her election in 2022, partly on a promise to investigate the elector strategy, she assigned a team of prosecutors to begin pursuing evidence.
Oh boy, I tell you what, like, I know that they're going to try and do some shenanigans in this next election, and I hope that we get enough people out to vote for Biden, that obviously it's a blowout. But I do think this is a warning to a lot of people now that if Trump tries to be like, hey, do this, let's put a scheme, they're going to tell him to go fuck himself, because I have a feeling enough people are getting in trouble for this stuff that maybe other people won't, you know, tag on in this next election to try and do some sketchy things as well.
Yeah.
It's my hope. And this one is from Alexandra Ward at Politico. The Biden administration last month secretly shipped long-range missiles to Ukraine for the first time in the two-year war. And Kyiv has already used the weapon twice to strike deep behind Russian lines. In March, the U.S. quietly approved the transfer of a number of Army tactile missile systems with a range of nearly 200 miles. This is what a senior Biden administration official and two U.S. officials allowed President Vladimir Zelensky. They allowed his forces to put at risk more Russian targets inside Ukrainian sovereign territory. The administration will include additional long-range ATACMS, right? I'm not supposed to say that in all its letters, right?
It's ATACMS.
Okay, ATACMS, in a new $1 billion package of military aid President Joe Biden approved on Wednesday. This is from one of the U.S. officials. The provision of long-range versions of ATACMS ends a lengthy drama in which Ukraine clamored for years to receive the weapon, driving a wedge between Washington and Kyiv. The U.S. quietly sent the medium-range version of the missile in October, but Ukraine continued to press for a weapon that would allow it to strike farther behind Russian lines. Ukrainian forces have used the long-range missiles twice, first against a Russian military base in Crimea, and more recently against Russian forces east of,
I think it's Berdansk.
Berdansk, thank you, near the Sea of Azov, and that's, again, from a senior administration official. The U.S. on Wednesday announced a new $1 billion package of weapons that will quickly be transferred to Ukraine now that Biden has signed off on the long-delayed foreign aid bill that just passed the Senate this week. Among other weapons, the tranche will include Stinger anti-aircraft missiles for air defense. Ooh. I know. 155-millimeter artillery rounds, Bradley fighting vehicles, Javelin anti-tank systems, and Claymore anti-personnel munitions, according to the Pentagon's press release. The Biden administration believes providing ATACMS can give Ukraine some new momentum in this two-year war, forcing Russia to move back critical command and control nodes and other high-value targets such as aviation assets. Again, this is from a second U.S. official. The long-range strategic missiles will also allow Ukraine to hold key parts of Crimea at risk. This is, again, from the officials that we have. That includes the Birch Bridge connecting occupied Crimea to Russia, as well as ports and naval facilities in the peninsula of which Russia's Black Sea Fleet operates. Biden approved the ATACM decision in mid-February, but had to wait for the funding battle over the supplemental to play out in Congress. He was waiting for Johnson to fucking do something. The House finally green-lighted more than $61 billion in Ukraine funding on Saturday, and the Senate followed suit Tuesday, sending it to Biden's desk for signature on Wednesday. In early March, however, Pentagon officials alerted colleagues that cost savings on other weapons contracts and humming production lines it allowed the U.S. to deliver long-range ATACMS before the supplemental's passage. I know, which is good because they kept that secret. Now, the weapons were then secretly sent as a part of a $300 million tranche of military aid announced in March. The U.K. announced its largest Ukraine aid package to date this week, which includes 1,600 missiles, including more Storm Shadows. France has also sent its Scalp missile, which has a similar range. Now that three allies have sent their long-range missiles to Ukraine, it adds more pressure on German Chancellor Olaf Scholz to send his long-range Taurus missile. His government so far has refused to do so, yet the move has significant support in the German parliament. So there's an interesting standout there.
All right. So Trump's going down. Bunch of indictments. I think the only problem we have left is the Supreme Court. I think that's...
it's a big problem. Yeah.
That, and we may have some more crimes coming out of the Trump organization here. This is from Roger Sullenberger at the Daily Beast. Donald Trump's legal payroll is easily the largest and most diverse of any political figure in modern U.S. history. But while most of the attorneys that Trump's various fundraising committees have paid over the years are a matter of public record, one of the top recipients still poses a mystery, with more than $8 million in legal costs going to an unknown firm or firms through what appears to be a corporate intermediary.
Oh, boy.
Hey, blah. Legal experts told the Daily Beast that the arrangement masks the true recipients of a significant amount of Trump's legal bills, depriving the public of that information while possibly running afoul of federal law. And the unprecedented structure of those payments, the experts said, potentially violates the ban on corporate contributions. For the last 15 months, five of Trump's political action committees, including his 2024 campaign, have paid out $8 million. In combined legal costs to a curious recipient called Red Curve Solutions. That's the firm that handles their political accounting. And Sullenberger doesn't mention this in the story, but Dana, remember when Trump allies offered Cassidy Hutchinson a nice cushy job in the midst of her testimony to the January 6th committee?
Yep.
That job was at Red Curve Solutions.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that total, by the way, makes Red Curve, a prominent Republican compliance firm, the largest single recipient of Trump legal payouts since he left office, receiving more money than even diehard defenders like Alina Habba, Stefan Passantino, John Lauro, and Jesse Banal. The Red Curve payments, however, are not described as being for legal services that the firm provides directly. In fact, Red Curve's website does not advertise legal services at all. And the FEC filings show that only one other federal committee has ever paid the company for legal work, and it was more than a decade ago. Instead, the payments are described in FEC filings as reimbursements for legal expenses and fees. Call me fucking crazy, but I believe that that is what Donald Trump is on trial for right now.
Oh, yes, he is.
Reimbursing Michael Cohen for legal fees when it was really to cover up hush money payments. The filings suggest that Red Curve is at least in part functioning as a financial hub for legal expense cost-sharing agreement between the various Trump committees. Now, Brendan Fisher, a campaign finance specialist and deputy executive director of Documented, said the reimbursement arrangement deprives the public of critical information and appears, Dana, to violate federal law.
Yeah, boy.
Quote, this appears to be illegal for two reasons, he said to the Daily Beast, citing potential violations of disclosure requirements and the corporate contribution ban. He said, when a campaign makes a reimbursement, it must report the payment to the person being reimbursed and also itemize the underlying vendor. That's what Fisher said, pointing to the FEC rules on candidate disclosures. The Red Curve reimbursements do not provide that itemization, and it's unclear which lawyers Trump is ultimately paying through the scheme. The second problem here, he says, is that these transactions may have resulted in Red Curve making illegal corporate contributions to Trump's committees. He explained that the FEC treats advanced payments, like basically Red Curve paying these lawyers and then being reimbursed.
Uh-huh.
That advanced payment to the lawyers from Red Curve, the FEC treats those as in-kind contributions, which are subject to contribution limits and other restrictions, depending on the type of committee. None of the Trump committees can accept donations from corporate entities. That's illegal. Quote, Red Curve is a corporation, so it can't lawfully make an advance to Trump's hard money committees, even if later reimbursed. Now, there's a lot more to this story. Roger Sullenberger explains it in awesome detail at the Daily Beast, so go check it out.
Thanks so much, AG. And last in this segment, this is from Alice Miranda Olstein at Politico. The Supreme Court heard nearly 2 hours of heated arguments Wednesday on the tension between Idaho's near-total abortion ban and a federal law requiring hospitals to offer any treatment, including an abortion, needed to stabilize patients in an emergency. It's the first time the high court has scrutinized an individual state's abortion ban since the justices overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022, and the justices were repeatedly confronted with the consequences of that decision, including stories of pregnant patients in Idaho being airlifted to other states. A few conservative justices at times joined the court's liberal wing Wednesday in asking tough questions that picked apart Idaho's argument that its hospitals should not be bound to provide abortions under the federal law at issue, known as the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, otherwise known as EMTALA. But it was far from clear whether those conservatives, most notably Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Amy Coney Barrett, were prepared to vote with the three liberals against Idaho. And several members of the court's six-justice conservative majority expressed deep skepticism of the federal government's power to impose limits on how states can regulate health care, including abortion. They're the ones that opened up this fucking Pandora's box, by the way. Multiple conservative justices also criticized the Biden administration's argument that Congress intended to override state laws when it passed the federal measure in 1986. Yeah.
Those were Republicans, by the way. Mm-hmm. That's a Republican law.
Yeah. Attorneys for both sides argued Wednesday that a win for their opponent would risk a cascade of unintended and dangerous consequences. Joshua Turner, Idaho's chief of constitutional litigation and policy, warned the justices that if they hold that EMTALA requires hospitals to provide emergency abortions that they are otherwise prohibited by state law, it's going to open up the door to federal government forcing other treatments that violate state law, including, and I quote, opioid use and informed consent requirements. That's quite the leap. Arguing for the Biden administration, Solicitor General Elizabeth Perlegar flatly rejected the claim, saying that the abortion is never the recommended standard of care in that circumstance because it, quote, wouldn't do anything to address the underlying brain chemistry issue that's causing the mental health emergency in the first place. Offering an abortion to a pregnant woman experiencing a psychotic episode or suicidal ideation, she added, quote, would be incredibly unethical. It would also violate standard of informed consent and it would never be required under federal government's interpretation of EMTALA. Prolegar then painted her own picture of the consequences of a win for Idaho, warning that allowing the state to carve abortion out of the treatments required under EMTALA would open the door to hospitals flouting other federal laws, like the prohibition against turning away patients who can't afford to pay. The justices seemed at their most tense and testy at any public event since they overturned the federal constitutional right to abortion almost 2 years ago. The liberal justices dominated the first 20 minutes or so of arguments, sometimes interrupting each other as they peppered Turner with questions and demanded he speak to various specific cases of women denied emergency abortions. That prompted three conservative justices to openly complain that the lawyer for Idaho wasn't being allowed to respond. Quote, "Could I hear your answer?" Roberts interjected at one point, cutting Sotomayor off. Justices Samuel Alito and Neil Gorsuch also griped about the liberals' rapid-fire questioning, with Alito, the author, as we know, he's the one that authored the 2022 Dobbs decision overturning Roe. He sometimes was leaning in far back in his chair and appeared irritated. Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry for you. Kagan launched a rocket at Turner, by the way, after he said EMTALA reflected, quote, "a humble approach by Congress that left intact states' authority to regulate medical treatment." Quote, "It may be too humble for women's health," she retorted.
Yeah, and she laid the hammer down a few times today during those oral arguments. She was great, talking about how, you know, using hypotheticals to show that abortion is health care.
Yeah.
And you can't, you know, because Alito was going on this fetal personhood thing, saying that the fetus enjoys the ability to not, you know, be harmed or, you know, anything like that by the hospital. But EMTALA is, it's about consent, and a fetus can't give consent. And the patient is the woman.
Right.
When you are trying to decide whether you need to take intervening steps to stop the deterioration of health. It's bizarre that they're even arguing this. But it's going to be interesting to see how it comes out. A lot of people are saying it could be 6-3 against Idaho.
Right.
But a lot of other people are saying they fear a 5-4 for Idaho.
We'll see. Thank you, AG.
Yeah, we'll see what ends up happening. All right, I'm going to be right back with the amazing Jennifer Murcia, and we're going to talk about why President Biden should not agree to a debate with Donald Trump. Stick around. We'll be right back.
After these messages, we'll be right back. Yeah.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. So today I wanted to talk about the debate about whether or not we should have a debate. And joining me to discuss this is the author of Demagogue for President, The Rhetorical Genius of Donald Trump. She's a contributing editor for Zocalo Public Square and a contributor for Resolute Square, where you can find her column Rhetorical Tricks. And she's also a professor at the Department of Communication and Journalism at Texas A&M University. Please welcome Jennifer Murcia. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
I am so happy to talk to you, and I'm glad I'm on your side because I don't want to debate you today.
I'm not much of a debater, to be honest.
But the big question on a lot of people's minds is whether or not Joe Biden should debate the presumptive Republican nominee, 88 criminal charges on trial now, dictator on day one, self-proclaimed nominee for president for the Republican Party, Donald Trump. And there's arguments for and against, and I know you've got a piece coming out on this, and I wanted to talk to you about it because I know you teach this stuff at Texas A&M. And talk a little bit about your position, you know, on whether or not Joe Biden should debate Donald Trump.
Yeah, I teach argumentation and debate. I have for 30 years. I was on the speech team. I coached the debate team. They went to nationals. I once tried to get a presidential debate on my campus. I worked with the university to do that. And I believe emphatically that Joe Biden should not debate Donald Trump.
Ah, can you tell us a little bit about why? Lay this argument out for us.
Well, because debate is linked to democracy, meaning that when political leaders give explanations for what they believe to be true and the policies that they prefer. They allow themselves to be questioned and they give answers. That serves the democratic interest. That's how we facilitate democracy. When political leaders don't do that, they're what we call cognitively irresponsible. They refuse to give good answers for what they want. In fact, it's authoritarian. Their answer is essentially, because I said so. Donald Trump does not debate. Donald Trump is a cognitively irresponsible leader. He refuses to earnestly and legitimately give good reasons for the things that he believes. He would much rather we merely obey.
Yeah, and that's kind of clear in the fact that we didn't even have a Republican platform in the last election.
We did
not. It wasn't about issues. And we know this election is really just about revenge and retribution. He's told us that with his mouth.
He has.
And so it doesn't seem like policy is something that he's even interested in talking about. And I've read a little bit of your work, and I know that you talk a lot about some of these rhetorical devices that cognitively irresponsible people use. And we've seen Trump use these in past debates, and I assume he would deploy them again if there were to be debates this election cycle. Talk a little bit about some of those devices.
Yeah, we have no reason to believe that this time would be any different. So Donald Trump treats debate as spectacle. And specifically, he's looking for a humiliation spectacle. He would like to engage in debate for one purpose only, and that is to dominate his opposition and humiliate them and expose them for whatever fraud he thinks they are. And so when he enters into a debate contract, before the debate even happens, he's starting already to exercise some of this domination strategy, meaning he puts pressure on the moderators. He puts pressure on the Commission for Presidential Debates. He puts pressure on the networks. He puts pressure on his opposition. He tries to do all kinds of things to shape public perception to his benefit. So that it's not a fair debate, it's not a true contest of ideas, but instead it's already a predetermined outcome that Trump wins. So he'll do things like poison the well, as a sort of old-timey logical fallacy. Poisoning the well is where you preemptively frame something and say that this is not going to be good, right? Like, so this debate, they're going to cheat. This debate, they're going to, you know, they're in the tank for Biden or whatever. This debate, the moderator's a liar. Does those kinds of things in order to convince his followers that no matter what happens, Trump didn't get a fair deal. He'll do things to try to shape how the rules are structured. So debates only work if there are rules. Otherwise, they are either speeches, right? Two people giving speeches next to each other, or they are people talking over one another. They are people interrupting one another. Donald Trump will try to shape the rules to his advantage. And all debaters, of course, in presidential politics do this. But he tries to do it in such a way that he disadvantages the opposition, advantages himself, and then he doesn't follow the rules that he's agreed to anyway. And then he'll attack again the Commission on Presidential Debates. He'll again attack the moderators during the debate, complaining about the rules that he has agreed to in advance to follow. Just like we've seen him do in court, he cannot be restrained. He cannot be gagged. He cannot be time limited, right? And so all of the things that a debate moderator would do, perhaps fact check, you know, none of those things are successful strategies against him. He refuses to comply.
Yeah, last time I think they had to add a mute button.
They did. He complained about.
Right. Now, I know, and we all know for a fact that the media, major media outlets have been clamoring and urging the Biden administration and the DNC, DCCC, whoever sets up these debates, to have debates, and they want them on their platform, for example. We know because of the whole Rana Romney McDaniel hiring and immediate firing over at NBC, that happened, like that whole thing started during when the networks were trying to get that town hall that CNN ended up getting. And then Chris Licht had to resign for having, and their ratings tanked because of that. And, you know, speaking of the Ronna Romney McDaniel situation, I know Lawrence O'Donnell went on that weekend and said, I don't have Trump liars on my show. It is impossible to interview them because you will ask one question and they will hit you with a fire hose of lies. And it is virtually impossible, if not actually totally impossible, to fact check all of the lies in real time. So I don't have these people on my show. And that is why I'm against having Ronna Romney McDaniel as a political contributor on this network. And so, of course, you know, they came back and at first said, OK, she won't be on MSNBC. And then finally, NBC is like, all right, well, we won't hire her at all. But that is another, I think, consideration that is kind of being left out of the conversation, that even if you do get rules set up, like you said, he ignores them. And then even the most earnest, honest, best debater and arguer in the history of arguers or anchors are unable to counter all of the fact check. It's impossible to fact check them in real time.
It's absolutely impossible. And so old-timey propaganda scholars call that a Gish Gallop. And that's where Trump will just run with 1,000, maybe not 1,000, 20 different lies, you know, in series. And you're trying to get the answer to a question, but he's said so many bizarre, strange, you know, things that you would fact check if you could. That it's impossible to even have a conversation with him. He talks so fast, in fact, that you can't get a word in edgewise to fact check him. That's one of his strategies. He is not someone who will ever have a conversation in good faith. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I noticed with David Pecker's testimony in the trial this week is, you know, just the way that he talked about how Trump knew all of the things, knew all of the stories. And I went back and looked in my book, and I have a couple of stories with the National Enquirer and Trump in the 2016 campaign. And one of them is the one in which Ted Cruz's dad, Rafael Cruz, is implicated somehow, maybe, you know, in this conspiracy, because there's a picture where it looks like some guy who the Warren Commission could never identify could maybe have been someone who looks like Rafael Cruz did, right? And that they're standing on a sidewalk, you know, in a state that's not Texas, and it's not November, but right, like somehow this means that Ted Cruz's dad shot JFK somehow. And the way that Donald Trump defended that story and defended himself repeating that story is really interesting to go back and look now that we know that he knew all along, because he is emphatic. He's like, the National Enquirer put it in. They're a legit news organization. They would not have put that in there because they could get into big trouble. They would not have put that in there if it wasn't true. And he just goes on and on and on telling the story, defending the veracity of the story, anchoring to the National Enquirer's legitimacy and authority, right, as evidence and proof. And the whole thing was a lie. And we now know he knew it was a lie. And that's the kind of thing that a fact checker or a moderator, like you said, as good as they are, you can't stop that as it's happening, because he's not someone who privileges truth.
No, yeah. And what about the idea? Because my first thought when, you know, I thought about, should we have debates this election season? My very first thought was, why legitimize him as a serious candidate for office? What are your thoughts on that? I mean, that's not the argument you're making. It was the argument that came into my head. But tell me what you think about that one.
Yeah, I think that's a real concern. Unfortunately, the Republican Party is legitimizing him. And so, right, the debates are useful for a functioning democracy. And in this country, the democracy functions when we have two legitimate political parties and they are playing fair, right? Donald Trump has taken over the Republican Party, and they're no longer acting as a legitimate political party. They are nominating someone who does not believe in democracy and does not believe in debate or democratic debate. And so Yeah, I mean, I do worry about normalizing him, but that train has already sailed. It's not us, and it's not the Commission on Presidential Debates that would be normalizing him. It is the Republican Party. And it's really a tragedy because voters do learn information from the debates. Many people will watch the first presidential debate and they will decide who to vote for, having paid attention to nothing before, and they will pay attention to nothing after. And they'll just watch the debate and they'll commit, you know, 2 hours of their life to that decision, and that'll be it for them. More people than you would suspect do that. And so, I mean, this is an unusual election in that we have two incumbents slash former president. Everyone has an opinion about both of them. And so I don't think we need to have a debate for that purpose, which would be the one legitimate Democratic purpose that I would say, yeah, we should do it. But it's a shame. I mean, it's a shame that the Republican Party is nominating Donald Trump.
Yeah, maybe just town halls for Joe Biden so he can at least get his policy out there. But, you know, the argument I hear on the other side is, well, maybe voters should see that to see, like, back in, you know, the debates of 2020. I don't think that those debates changed many minds. I don't think a lot of people watched that debate and said, well, I was on the fence, but now that I see the way Trump is acting, I'm going to vote for Joe Biden. I'm not sure about that argument. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. So the 2020 debate, especially the first one, was an unmitigated disaster for democracy, democratic decision making. Donald Trump interrupted Chris Wallace, the moderator, before he even asked the first question and started yelling at him. He continued to yell and harass the moderator, Joe Biden. He was a monster, right? And so, yeah, there's some benefit to seeing that, but we've already seen that. I don't think that anyone would be surprised to see that. And frankly, if we need to see it, we can show that debate again. It's on tape.
Very, very good point. Very good point. Well, thank you for coming and speaking with us, educating us about these devices and about, you know, cognitive responsibility and how debate is tied to democracy. I think that those are all really, really important points. And giving an authoritarian a debate stage is, it's not debate. It doesn't make any sense. So thank you so much. Would you let everybody know where they could find you and follow you, find your work?
I hang out mostly on Twitter, where I'm active. I will never call it X. You can read my column on Resolute Square. Yeah. Otherwise, I have some other social media accounts, but I don't do much with them.
Jennifer Mercia, thank you so much again for your time.
My pleasure.
Everybody, stick around. We'll be right back with the good news. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's time for the good news.
Who likes good news?
Good news, good news. And if you have any good news, confessions, corrections, you want to send in a photo or a drawing of an animal and we'll just try to guess something about it or just enjoy it. We'll just look at it and go, I love this. If you want to send your pod pet and pay your pod pet tax, you can do that. And if you don't have a pod pet, you can send us an adoptable pet in your area and we'll see if we can get them a forever home. You can also send shout outs to yourself, loved ones, kids, parents, anybody you want to shout out, small business in your area, your small business. Or if you want to send thesis titles or dissertation titles, we love those. Dana loves baby pictures. I love frog orgies. Send us your happy place and just maybe a nice note. But also if there's any Democratic program that has benefited you personally, we'd love to hear about it, especially student debt relief. We love those stories. Send it all to us at dailybeanspod.com and click on contact. All right, first up, a quick correction from Steve Bev, pronouns he and him. Love you, love all your hard work. Slight but important correction. DG suggests that judges' criticisms of Blanche, quote, you're losing your credibility, unquote, in the contempt hearing was in front of the jury. The jury was not present for the contempt hearing. But please keep up your good work.
Thank you, Steve Bev, for that. And I did not know that. And it's nice to learn these things. Also, I guess that would make them, like, that would skew their opinion? Like, if they, why wouldn't they be present for that? Because it's just the judge's decision. They don't have a say in it, I guess?
No, because it's not for them. It's not evidence of the case. It could be prejudicial against
prejudicial.
Trump.
That's the word I was looking for.
Yeah.
All right. I'll read this cute little one for this peanut. This is from anonymous pronouns he and him. I listen to you guys every day. I'd like to introduce you to Frankie. I think you're wonderful. And I think Frankie is the cutest dog ever. And I am definitely on the Frankie train. That this fucking pup is adorable.
Is this a puppy? Or is this a full grown? It looks like a puppy.
I think it's
to
a puppy. I do think it's a Chihuahua puppy, but I think it's a puppy.
Well, I also think Frankie is one of the cutest dogs ever. Thank you, Anonymous, for sending that in. Next up from Annie O, pronouns she and her. I want to give a shout out to my great friend Kathleen in Colorado. I'm in California. She would send that. That was Annie, by the way, not me. I think you all know I'm in California, but so is Annie who sent this in. She would send me Beans episodes that she thought I would find interesting. I recently started subscribing, and now we talk and text about the news with swearing and how awesome you two are. Aw. We recently met up for a visit and happily listened to the Daily Beans together.
Nice.
See, that's it. Bringing friends together.
Listening parties.
When I finally... That's a good idea.
Yep.
When I finally got out of bed after the 2016 election, Annie, I feel you, I felt that I had not been doing my part for democracy and have since become a bit of an activist. I joined a local action group, have marched, and written thousands of postcards, sometimes with the help of my sisters and nieces, to fight voter suppression and get out the vote. I have been an HRC member for 5 years.
Oh.
And we proudly fly an inclusion flag in front of our house in a fairly conservative neighborhood. My husband and I hope to make it to an HRC event in the near future. Thank you both for keeping me relatively sane during these insane times. We adopt, don't shop. This is a picture of our beautiful, crazy Lucy. Aww. She was with us for almost 16 years. She left this earth a few months ago, but is in our hearts forever.
Lucy is cute too. My goodness, this is a cute pup. Good news today.
This looks straight out of a show. This actually looks like the Brady Bunch driveway. Did you send us a television dog, Annie O? Because this is an adorable
It really does
dog.
Look like a television dog.
Adorbs. Thank you for sending that in, and hearts out to you for the Rainbow Bridge. I mean,
yeah,
it's so hard to lose our pet friends.
Big time. All right. This one's from Cassie, pronouns she and her. My husband and I just got back from an incredible trip to Scotland. And while I was sad because it made me miss the DC Beans meetup, my darling husband made it up by booking me a falconry experience at one of our hotels. This has been a dream of mine since I was a preteen. I think I read a medieval fantasy book that briefly mentioned it. And I finally got to fulfill that dream. And it was better than I could have ever imagined. We got to meet and interact with 5 different birds. I'd love to hear what your guesses are. And don't worry, there's at least one that you'll get for sure. I don't know. Don't put that by us.
Yeah.
Maybe there's an owl. I love all your podcasts and missed them while I was in Scottish countryside with no good internet. I can't wait to come to Seattle Live Show and meet you all this July. Well, Cassie, we can't wait to meet you either. And excuse me, there is an owl is the first picture.
Yeah.
It may not just be a regular owl. There might be 85 different kinds of owls, but that's an owl.
Yeah, my guess would be owl.
Ernie.
And it's Ernie, the Verroes eagle owl.
There we go, in the wild.
In the wild, he would eat eagles, but I saw him try to eat a clump of moss. Smart, he isn't, but he's super cute.
This looks like a falcon. I just made that up. A red-winged falcon. A red-shouldered falcon.
Red-shouldered falcon. I like that one. All Let's go with that. Let's see.
Oh, Grummy, I meant to say hawk, by the way.
Hawk. The feminist Harris hawk.
Oh.
Harris hawk. He shows different preference for women and femme-presenting handlers. Harris hawks are highly social and matriarchal, so maybe that's why.
Oh.
Oh, how very cool. Either way, he loved me and he had to be bribed with meat to go to my husband. All right.
I do believe this is a bald eagle.
I got this one. Bald eagle. Ooh,
whoop, whoop.
Yep. All right. You want to read the...
Sure. Electra, the bald eagle. She was seriously the last thing I expected to see in a foreign country, but holding a bald eagle made me feel very incredibly American. Compared to the other bird, she was massive and weighed a ton. Yep. That sounds about right. We also go to meet Mito. Mito. We're going to go with Mito. The middle-aged Peregrine Falcon.
Love Peregrine Falcon.
Why? I mean, does anyone else have as much problem with pronunciations as I do? Why do you know these words? Like these types of birds and stuff?
Oh, man. I don't know. I watched Planet Earth.
Oh, maybe that's it. All right. Well, Peregrine Falcon, who was about the size of a crow, but the best hunter of the lot, and Anarchy, a striated Caracara, who solved dog treat puzzles for fun.
How fucking cool is this?
That sounds like a blast.
Now, I want to know where you went, because I want to go, Cassie. So let us know. All right. Next up from Annie, pronouns she and her. My Social Security story is one not often told. In 1960, my birth parents died of separate illnesses 6 months apart when I was 5. My mother's siblings had literally 1 week to decide what to do with two little girls under 7 years old. We ended up with my mother's sister and became part of a larger family. Our new parents went from a family with 3 kids under 8 to having 5 kids under 8. Two things were godsends. One was that our mother had life insurance that paid for college and grad school for the both of us. The second, Social Security. They received a check from the government every month that helped with living expenses and clothes for us, etc. While Social Security could have stopped at 18, because we went to college, we received it until we were 21. It paid for everyday expenses for us. I've never begrudged a penny of my paycheck that came out of my paychecks all those years. I love listening to you two. Keep up the good work. Annie, thank you. A shout out to Social Security that we usually talk about student debt forgiveness, but that's a Dem program, Social Security. And to this day, Republicans are trying to either gut it or privatize it.
Yeah. All right. This one's from Kyle, pronouns he and him. I wanted to shout out the VA and PACT Act. I'm a 37-year-old Army veteran with a deployment to Afghanistan in 2014. In August of 2023, the VA accidentally found a mass on my kidney, which turned out to be a kidney cancer. I had a partial nephrectomy fairly quick in September of 23. During my first follow-up scans, the VA had another incidental find that they think is testicular cancer. Mm-hmm. I've been scheduled for surgery 8 days after discovery of the mass. Due to the early detection of both, my prognosis is great, and I'll continue to be there for my wife and our 2-year-old son. Mm-hmm. This is all covered under the PACT Act, and I won't have to worry about medical fees. While this does suck, I'm focusing on the positive in the situation and truly thankful for the VA and the PACT Act. This is, Kyle, this is crazy. Like, yeah. I am one of those people that I think things happen for a reason. I don't think you got cancer for a reason, but the fact that they found these accidentally and caught them early, that is a blessing, and I'm so glad they did. Your son is adorable. The pup is adorable. And I have no doubt
The
wife is lovely. So I'm so glad you have hopefully decades longer with your family.
Look at all these babies.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you so much for that. Shout out to the VA and the PACT Act. I appreciate that. Next up from Anonymous, no pronouns. Can I share a joke my trans daughter told me? What does a non-binary samurai do to their enemies? They slash them. Thank you, AGDG, for serving a daily feast of delicious schadenfreude. Every day, I gorge on the tasty treats of justice explained to a crispy perfection. Each morning, I'm hungry for more full servings of law and less odor. I get it. Thank you, Anonymous. And yeah, boy, today is a justice-y cornucopia. It is a smorgasbord of justice for you today. Crispy and delicious.
It sure is. All right. This is Laura M, pronouns she and her. Dear AG and DG, now that I've wiped away my tears from last week's good news segment, I thought I'd drop you a line to let you know how much you both mean to me. The last letter from Anonymous had me feeling a little wrecked, and I was with you through your whole discussion. Damn, I feel you. Please, please keep choosing the stories and letters that you find important. They're important to me, too. I feel smarter and better informed by listening to you. Please keep up the good, hard work. Whew. Now for pet tax. I offer you this picture of my two goofballs, Todd, the tabby, and Lincoln, the void. Bring joy and laughter to my life every day. I hope they make you smile. This picture is fucking hysterical, by the way. I don't know if there's water in that bowl. I'm assuming there's not. But the fact that you have to call a cat and go, Todd, come here, makes me very happy.
Todd and Lincoln, named after Mary Todd Lincoln, maybe?
Maybe.
I don't know. It's probably something totally different. Like the two have nothing to do with each other.
Yeah,
but I love it.
Could be.
Anyway, thank you everybody for sending in your good news. And thanks for sticking with us today, especially me with my hoarse voice. I don't know what's going on. I'm either under the weather or it's allergies or all the work or talking. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what's going on with me. I feel okay.
Okay, good.
But yeah, I appreciate you hanging in with my voice the way that it is. Do you have any final thoughts for all this news before we get out of here?
You know, I'm going to leave you with my favorite stock joke. And if you guys don't know what a stock joke is, it's a joke that you did not write. It's just one that sort of circulates. But I don't know if a lot of people have heard this. There's a proctologist walking around a hospital and one of the nurses comes up to him and says, "Doc, there's a rectal thermometer behind your ear." And he grabs it and he goes, "Oh, shit, that means some asshole's got my pen."
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite ones. You're welcome.
That's interesting. You call them stock jokes. I call them street jokes.
Oh.
So if you have a different name for what that kind of joke is, or if you want to send us your favorite stock or street joke,
yeah,
you can do that at dailybeanspot.com and click on contact. That's a good one.
Right.
I think one of my favorite street joke is what is blue and smells like red paint?
Blue paint.
You got it. You got it.
Okay. Here's my other one. And it's not it's just sort of like, there's no answer to mine, which are my favorite. So this turtle got jumped by three snails and the cops asked him what happened. And he goes, "I don't know. It all happened so fast." So that joke makes me laugh all the time. And if I've had any alcohol, I get giggly.
It all happened so fast. Look at that escargot. All right. Sometimes my mom loves to tell jokes, but she forgets the entire joke and she only knows the punchline. So she'll sit there tearing up, just repeating a punchline over and over again. And she would be like, "What was that joke your dad told? I rang the doorbell, didn't I? Ha, 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 ha." And she'll just die laughing.
Oh my God, that would get me every time though. I would find so much joy watching. I mean, it might drive me crazy, but watching my mother in tears from laughter would make me so happy.
And she doesn't even know the setup, but the punchline cracks her up.
Doesn't matter.
So funny. It's so good. All right, everybody.
Thanks for coming to our open mic. We appreciate it. We hope you have a great day.
Tip your servers, tip your wait staff.
Don't try the veal. We'd like to save them.
I'll be here all week. All right, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow. Until then, please take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Take care of the planet. Take care of your mental health. Take care of your family. Vote blue over Q.
And take all that family with you.
I've been AG.
And I've been DG.
And them's the Beans.
The Daily Beans is written and executive produced by Allison Gill, with additional research and reporting by Dana Goldberg. Sound design and editing is by Desiree McFarlane, with art and web design by Joel Reeder with Moxie Design Studios. Music for The Daily Beans is written and performed by They Might Be Giants, and the show is a proud member of the MSW Media Network, a collection of creator-owned podcasts dedicated to news, politics, and justice. For more information, please visit mswmedia.com.
MSW Media.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money that'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler...
How much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary.
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, "Show me, in a courtroom, how we were at war."
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing on the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, "If I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized."
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.